Welcome to this edition of When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine, a discussion of sustainable living, a discussion, and what that means to you and me. I'm Jay Warmke.
And I'm Annie Warmke.
And today we're going to talk about natural gardening, or you can't fight Mother Nature. That one was a little weak.
You come up with. I know now why you don't tell me ahead of time.
That's all right. So tell me how we're not going to fight Mother Nature. Well, we were talking about natural gardening, and my first question, of course, to you was, well, what is unnatural gardening? You know, unnatural could be a lot of things, I'm assuming.
I think unnatural would be to garden in the nude. Absolutely.
That could be very natural.
No, there's lots of stickers and bugs and
garden,
all that.
Garden of Eden, baby. So, all right.
Stop it. That was awful.
All right. Okay, gardening. So tell me some of the problems we have with gardening and
okay,
how we've
unnatural.
Gone from the Garden of Eden to this present day.
I don't know if we've gone from the Garden
of
Eden or not, but we have gone from the idea that that we would work with nature and that instead we're going to fight nature. So that's why there are things that are unnatural, like spraying of chemicals. I mean, lots of chemicals that have been sprayed on land for growing food and flowers over the course of the last 50 years were developed for war.
Well, the ammonia-based fertilizer industry, I mean, ammonia was a wartime invention.
Like Agent Orange kind of stuff.
Yeah, so we've got insecticides that are designed to kill pests, and these are warfare developed items. We have fertilizers that are ammonia based primarily.
And we can blow stuff up with them, so we just spray them on things.
So you're taking all of these chemicals and trying to manipulate an environment that would grow things pretty naturally if we just
absolutely. Let it. So unnatural, just to finish answering your question. We want to act like we're gonna tame nature, which is constantly changing, constantly morphing, constantly trying to take back for itself what belongs to us, like a forest. You cut down the forest, and if you leave it alone, it's going to start to grow plants that utilize a lot of light, and then that will create shadow for the ones that don't use as much light, and then those will get taller so that the there's more shade, and it's really amazing to watch what happens over time.
Well, I know at Blue Rock Station, I'm constantly hacking back the jungle that's trying to retake us. And we see those things. I know there are some of those specials where they say, if humans disappeared from the planet, you know, how many years would it be until New York City looks like a jungle? And you know, it's a surprisingly short amount of time. Things grow.
Yes, they do. And look at Mount St. Helens. You know, a volcano came and wiped out that place, but within 10 years there was new growth and new things. But the thing about unnatural gardening is that instead of working with nature and saying that all those first plants that come, for example, when you cut down the forest, they often have lots of food that could be consumed by humans, we say, get rid of that. We don't want that. Also unnatural would be to create plants and life where we can't save the seed. So it cannot reproduce on its own or in a natural way.
Mm-hmm. And that type thing is just motivated by corporate greed.
Well, yes, because they want to do something that's absolutely unconstitutional, and that is to own seed. The Constitution's very specific about owning that kind of thing, patenting seed.
Yeah, I know. We have a long history of allowing people to own life.
That's the truth.
I know.
Slavery. Mm-hmm. The other thing is that in trying to be unnatural and fighting nature is that we have said that we bring plants that aren't native that can't adjust to the environment. So what we really want to do is to work with nature, not against it. And so we want to grow in a way that's more native and more natural. So I know when I first was seriously wanting to grow food, I had this great idea. I wanted to have a cottage garden. And I love cottage garden. I had been living in England and it was just so beautiful. And it's really a great way to incorporate vegetables with plants. But then I chose a bad location and location, location, location. is the key.
So bad location like Ohio?
No, like where you're going to put your plants.
Okay, all right. No, Ohio, a little more specific of
especially,
a location.
Especially the 32 Appalachian counties of Ohio are really fantastic, rich places for plant life and herbal, medicinal herbals and things like that. Anyway, so the space that I wanted to put my cottage garden and grow my vegetables and everything, it turned out that it held water about 70% of the year. And I had no way of knowing that. So everything I planted rotted. And that was bad on my part and naive on my part. So instead of fighting nature...
You should have planted rice.
Well, not really, because the ground's hard as a rock. And that was the other problem mm-hmm. I had was that... naturally, clay, you know, clay is a tiny little speck under glass, mm-hmm. under a microscope, that becomes a hard ball when it comes together, when it's right. dry.
And as you say, nature always seems to have a habit of winning. And it just reminded me what you were saying there. We were trying to plant fruit trees in this nice clay environment. And we were having trouble because when you dug a hole, you're basically creating this clay pot. And then water would fill it up, and then it would saturate the roots, and they would rot.
In the wintertime, when all the repair of the roots is going on, they would rot.
So I read a book on how to fix that problem, and it said downhill from where the hole is that you just dug, dig another hole that will allow the water to drain out of the hole that you just dug. And I thought, oh, okay. So I went out and dug this other hole, and then I had a bigger clay pot because they both filled up with water.
So my uncle, who was quite the, not just a gardener, but also an arborist, I asked him what to do, and he said, lift him up out of the ground.
Yeah, build a raised bed. So that's what we ended up doing,
with
of
tires.
Course.
With tires.
With most of our plantings is say, all right, if we've got this clay soil that doesn't drain, I guess we have to build up an artificial bed that then will drain.
Right. So we use tires for the fruit trees and raised beds with, 4x8 or so pieces of, not pieces, but 4x8 beds for growing things. Anyway, the point is that we needed to say, what is nature giving us? And then how can we use that to the best advantage for all concerned, for its highest purpose? And I think it also, in terms of natural gardening, if I'm looking at a site and I'm saying I want to grow something there, what I really have to do is to take into consideration everything that's happening there. So I remember early on when we were getting ready to dig a pond, and I was thinking about what was I going to plant there and around it and everything, and this killdeer came and she laid some eggs and she was carrying on like crazy. We needed her not to be there because we were digging this pond. And then at some point we said, why are we fighting? Let's just let her do what she needs to do. And then when they hatch, we'll go back to digging the pond. And that became a really important point in my career as somebody who grows food, is that I wanted to look at everything. I wanted to look at where's the water naturally, where's the good ground naturally? What kind of insects, what kind of animals are drawn to that space? What kind of birds are going to come there? And how, as a human being, am I going to be able to work as a partner in that space? So that's the first part of natural gardening, is to say that I'm just a part of that space. And what does it have to offer me? And what is it that I can do to help that space to stay as natural as possible? Because if I'm growing something, so for example, I have lots of medicinal herbs that grow around our farm, but I haven't planted them. Now, we could say, let's just weed whack because they're all weeds or whatever. But instead, what we've done is say, all right, this space is for this particular group of medicinal herbs. And then we mulch with leaves. We cut them at the appropriate time and preserve them as we need to. But they're not in a garden. They're where they grow naturally. So that mm-hmm. would be an idea about naturally raising things.
So that's just an extension of saying plant what wants to be there, or if it's already there, maybe just let it be there.
Yeah, if it's useful to plants or animals, The other, I mean, to humans or animals, but the other thing is, for example, as far as woodlands are concerned, you know, forest gardening has become something fairly popular with lots of farm people because the forests have kind of just been there, even though our livestock really ought to be in the forest because that's where they came from, naturally eating in the forest. But the forest is full of nuts and fruits and all kinds of amazing things, but we don't know what to do with it. So when we look at that space and we say, let's analyze what's there, let's identify what's there, that tells us a lot about what's been there in the past, and it also tells us what's possible in the future. So if I back up, because I'm talking like a farmer, and really most people who are going to be listening are not farmers, I want to also talk about lawns, because lawns have a lot of potential, but not in the way we use them. So lawns are, grass is the biggest crop that we grow in this country, and it produces nothing. It's also a huge consumer of really bad chemicals. It's a big pollution pit, so to speak. But if we have these lawns that can grow up and be more like a meadow, where they attract all kinds of beneficial insects and also other critters that maybe people find to be something they don't want, but little snakes and toads and things like that.
What we, so far, you're really selling this.
I love all that. I love that. We have a rain garden that's full of lovely little toads, and they come in the in February when the when there's a flooded area, and they it's a vernal pond, as they call it, and they sing and have a dance they do. And it's
but
really
one of the
incredible
problems people are going to have is if you're in a city or a suburb and you try and convince the code inspector that this is a meadow, not a lawn. And they're going to have very little sympathy because our laws try and keep us, again, from being non-sustainable.
Well, it's not just non-sustainable, but we're consuming. It's a, lawns are consuming huge amount of money to corporations. But we can allow space. We can allow space for a meadow. It could be the size of
just
a 4x4.
Make a border around it, and then suddenly it looks like you
maybe
did something.
Or put it in the backyard, not in the front. But that meadow, that little meadow, even if it's 4x4, has the potential to bring a lot of beneficial insects and critters to your gardening that will eat bugs and take care of things for you.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and you can also then, as you were talking about trying to deal with water issue, you know, the rain gardens and trying to deal with drainage in a way that nature wants to drain. You know, we always try and fight nature, and we always lose whenever we... I mean, look at a city like New Orleans, you know, built below the floodplain. We're always ultimately going to lose if we don't adapt ourselves to what nature wants to do.
Right. Well, we don't have anything set up really to do that very, very well. Some cities are starting to do better with some of that in their zoning and planning. And but I think we're moving towards that mainly because we don't have a choice. We have to do better. And as things change through climate change and weather changes, these things are going to be more obvious that we have to try to do better.
Okay, well, you are listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke, reminding you it is indeed the end of the world as we know it.
And thank God.
Thank God. There you go. So today we're talking about natural gardening. Working with nature, against nature. One of the terms you hear a lot, and I love how people love to label things, but like xeriscaping or what's the other one that we hear a lot about?
I don't know.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at you, and it's like...
I don't know. I'm not big on knowing these things.
Permaculture. Permaculture. Yeah, everybody. I took a class in permaculture, and, you know, you got to work with nature and not against nature. I said, that took a long time to take that class, I hope.
Well, as human beings, we like to give labels. That's how our brain is able to collect and maintain and keep information. And so that's good that there are these names out there. But what it really comes back to is more about common sense and paying attention. So you can call it whatever you want. And I'm glad there are these classes out there. You can take a master gardening class through your local extension office in almost any state and learn all about a lot of things we're talking about and much more because they're not rooted in the kinds of things that I'm talking about so much. They're very broad in terms of growing and propagating and things like that. It's a great way to learn the basics. And there are lots of classes out there on permaculture and natural gardening and organic gardening and all that.
Well, one of the things around gardening that people are always fighting is critters, pests, you know, bugs that are eating their crops, deer that are eating their crops, raccoons that are coming in and tearing ears of corn off of whatever. And I know you deal with that a lot. So tell us your wisdom.
I personally haven't had too much of that, although lately, since we don't have a livestock guardian dog, we have deer that actually came up by the back door, which was like a shocker. Well, the thing is, that's part of why you want to study the space, because if you don't realize that these critters are hungry and wanting to gain access, and you don't create a way to try to prevent it, and that's all you're going to do is try to prevent it. So, for example, in a natural way, in looking at things, and versus I'm going to sit there with my shotgun and shoot the critters, is that I would want to create several barriers to that critter wanting to come into my space in my garden. So, first of all, I wouldn't plant the things that that critter likes to eat so much. I'd on the outside, you know, I wouldn't put it towards the outside of the garden. I want to put things that they aren't going to like too much, or things that maybe they don't like the smell of. And certainly there are quite a few of those things versus corn on the outside of the garden. So the other thing you can do is have a really high fence. So that would be another type of barrier. Again, these are many barriers you should have. You're not going to keep them out with an 8-foot fence because they'll figure it out, but you're hindering them.
I mean, you've used chili powder and things like that.
Well, you can go to the hairdresser or the dog groomer and you can collect up hair. And this hair has the scent that a deer or a coon doesn't want to smell. They smell that and they're uneasy. And then you could get some old sheets and you could roll the hair in a like a bed roll kind of thing, you know, a long bed roll, and you put that further out, because that's one of the first things you want this animal to smell and notice, is that there may be a human. So this would be beyond the plantings, beyond the fence. And then you can also take a soap that's still in the package, a really good smelly soap, like Irish Spring.
Ah, that's what I was thinking.
Irish Spring. Uh-huh. I'm sure you're going to.
It's not just for raccoons anymore, but I like it too, right?
Oh, yeah. So anyway, beyond the commercial for Irish Spring, and you tie that maybe to the fence, but more likely better further out away. So if there are trees or maybe some post that you can hang up. And all of these are a line of defense that says to that critter, maybe I should go to the next place and try their food.
Well, another thing you've done is don't plant everything all in like a group. I mean, nature doesn't do that. They don't put like everything in pretty rows, you know, all together.
Because I have pretty rows.
Well, there you go.
But here's the thing.
It's what we've always said about you, Annie. But
I don't want to hear an explanation of that on the radio. But here's the thing. So that is for the possibility of destruction. So I plant some things in one place and some of those very same things in maybe three places or four places. So if a critter comes and destroys it, or there's too much rain, or there's something else happens to it, blight or whatever, I still have those vegetables or those fruits or those herbs in another place.
And you have planted things for the bugs or for the animals that, like, for instance, if a certain pest is attracted to tomatoes, maybe plant some plant they like even better that you don't care about, so you can deflect their attention.
Right. Well, that's called companion planting. So one of the things that I believe in studying a space is that I'm not really planning to kill the bugs. What I want to do is have balance with insects in my garden. So what I want to do is to say, well, the good bugs need bad bugs to eat. And so how do we maintain that kind of balance? And we can do that with plants sometimes. So if I have a tomato plant and I don't want certain bugs to come and eat on my tomatoes, if I plant marigolds around the perimeter of the plant, also, if you think about what goes really well with tomatoes, things like garlic and onions, those are good deterrents to other bugs. Because what happens is most insects that you're going to find in the garden carry their smelling capabilities on their side where their stomach is. And they're walking along and they are sniffing to find the plants. So they depend on that sense of smell. And then they start to think they smell a tomato. But then it's like, wait a minute, it's kind of mixed up in the garlic and the onion. And the marigolds are very, very smelly. They have a very strong scent. And it says, nope, I think I'll keep going. And that's one way you can change things in your garden to create a better balance. I also have planted things like tobacco, which is a really great host for a lot of pollinators. So all kinds of things will collect on the nicotinia or the tobacco, and then they will go and pollinate in my garden. And a lot of people are...
Plus, it's a pretty plant.
Well, and it can be somewhat invasive because if you live in, even in northern states, it can seed itself back, but it's easy enough to destroy it just by raking it and destroying the plants. It's also an insecticide, so you can dry the leaves. I know you can smoke them, but that's not my interest. But you can dry the leaves, and then you can soak the leaves that are dried in a gallon of water. And you can use that as a spray, and it will kill just about any kind of bug but a potato bug. So, and it is lethal. I mean, if you see those green hornworms that like to get on tomatoes, mm-hmm. and they will just eat, they'll just devour everything. But if they get on nicotinia and they happen to get where there's just a little dried bit of the leaf, it'll be dead almost immediately.
Don't you have to worry about like skin sensitivity with some of those?
It doesn't bother me, but when I've had people processing it with me, it can bother them. Yeah, I mean, tobacco is a really tough plant environmentally. I mean, for humans, really tough on humans.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, but it is great. You know, I like to dust with something called diatomaceous earth, and I like to dust my plants with that because it's made from diatoms, which are little critters that used to live in the ocean when the west part of this country was an ocean, and then the oceans dried up over time. And so they collect up the diatoms now, and they make the water softener. You buy bags of the diatomaceous earth and you put it in water softener. But this diatomaceous earth that I use is called flour grade, F-L-O-U-R, like cake flour. If you look at it under a microscope, it looks like a nunchuck. So it's got all these barbs on it. So insects carry moisture on the outside of their body, and this flour is just like a giant dehydrator. So when a bug crawls across the leaf and it gets that moisture on their skin, it does two things. It begins to cut the body of the insect, and it doesn't kill it right away. So like for ants, for example, that ant will go back to its friends and cousins and neighbors and share the diatomaceous earth it's wearing, and everybody dies.
Well, you've also ground up eggshells for the same reason. I mean, not only do they add calcium into the soil, but yeah, they do slice up slugs.
Well, tomatoes require lots of calcium, or they get something called bloom rot. Is it called bloom rot? Anyway, the end where the bloom is on the tomato will rot. And that's from lack of calcium, which can happen if there's too much rain, but also a deficiency in calcium in the soil. And so I grind up, really finely grind up eggshells and put around under the canopy. And then when slugs want to come and destroy my beautiful tomatoes, they are cut. You can almost hear them going, ouch, 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 and they die because slugs are really gross.
So those are some of the natural insecticides, eggshells, diatomaceous earth, tobacco, nicotinia. What about some of the fertilizers?
Well, good old poop. You know, first of all, we try to start with good soil. So we're lucky in that we live on a farm and we have what we call deep bedding in the winter with our livestock. So we have all this poop that's mixed up with urine and all the good stuff that makes good compost and heats it up quickly. And then we put that someplace so it becomes really black soil, and then that gets added to all of our raised beds. So that's what we start with, is good compost. But it also has sometimes some depletion in it minerally. So we'll make up teas with different kinds of poops, and use that when the plants are setting their fruits, because there's a need for more nitrogen at that point for the plant. And in the fall, we'll put lots of eggshells and things around. We're looking to create some potassium, because the root systems in plants are repairing and growing in the wintertime. So we have a lot of different things that we're going to do naturally to encourage that plant to do what it needs to do. And the healthier the plant, the less likely it's going to be destroyed by bugs.
But another thing that was kind of surprising to me when we were doing this is not all manures are equal. Made equal.
I mean, no, they're not.
We had a load hauled in from the fairgrounds, and oh, that was a disaster, right? You know, all of the worming and everything that
there were needles
in it, filters. And oil filters and bits of metal.
Well, so you want to know, just like everything we talk about, you want to know where it comes from and what's been done with it. So the other thing that we try to do is plant for the critters. So there are things going to come along and do things to those plants. So let's have some for everybody, so that we're saying we live together.
One for you, one
that's
for me.
That's right. And also, you brought up companion planting. So that's a really good way to plant, of how different plants help other plants. And there are actually some weeds that are very beneficial to other plants in helping protect them from bugs. And succession planting we use in natural gardening. So maybe we plant lettuce in the early spring, and then that will all get taken out by the beginning of June, and we'll put in a row of squash or something like that. And then we might plant a late garden again once the squash is gone, and put in some kale and things like that.
Aren't weeds just the garden I didn't plant?
Well, weeds have many benefits if you understand their beneficial nature.
Okay, well, you've been listening to When the Biomass Hits the Wind Turbine with Jay and Annie Warmke. We want to thank our award-winning producer, Adam Rich, and thank you for spending just a wee bit of time with us. And as your grandmother hopefully told you, the secret to a happy and sustainable life is...
play nice with others, clean up your own mess, and plant a garden.
Plant a garden, and then eat those vegetables. Until next time.
Bye-bye. Mother Earth will sing, and her children will be...
You can find more information on living sustainably in our unsustainable world at BlueRockStation.com.